This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
Hi, my name is Wing Fan. I am the owner of Anchovies and Salt, Renton area in the greater Seattle area of Washington. Thanks for having me, Kenneth.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Thanks for agreeing to come on. First off, congratulations. I've been following your journey through the Viet Leaders Forum. They do a wonderful job of keeping us all up to date with your endeavors at Anchovies and Salt. Tell me a little bit about how the idea of this restaurant came into being.
I came to the U.S. when I was 10, and I was fortunate enough to be able to go back to see Saigon for the first time, kind of with an adult perspective, right? I left when I was 9 years old, and I was really mesmerized by what it was becoming back in 2003. I think I was 22 years old at the moment. And I just thought to myself, I was like, where's all of this in Seattle or California? And, you know, I just remember going to like places that was really big, like Lang Nung or Wang Long in Saigon, right? And we're just amazed by how much culture we had to share with people. And we knew that in terms of what we eat at home, you know, but to kind of see food from so many vendors or so many different styles, it was just, you know, eyes opening when you are young and impressionable. And I always thought that the community, my community here in Seattle, needed something that was like that. I knew I would be there. I knew I would take my friends and family there, and I would be proud to have that in my neighborhood, in my community. And, you know, I didn't see it coming. I think it takes a certain background. You know, my parents, my mom is in the restaurant business, and she always worked for somebody. And I knew she can cook, but the place that she worked at, you know, is, you know how it is. It's we offer the very basic, right? The pho, the banh mi of the world, especially when the community is not big yet and you don't get, like, people don't understand our food yet. So I always dreamt of, okay, I dreamt it for somebody else. I dreamt it for my community. I dreamt it for my people, right? And because we know there's so much more for us. And the longing in Seattle always made us venture back to Vietnam, or we would take short family vacation to Orange County, to where you guys are at down there. And, yep, you know, the talk of every community is, well, we should go to Orange County, California to eat the best Vietnamese food. We can go to Houston, probably the second best Vietnamese food, and maybe San Jose, you know. But, you know, like, what the opposite, it rings true when people come to Seattle and who are friends of mine, and they would just make fun of the community. They would just say, like, man, you guys have nothing to do. It's just raining up there, you know? So they land, they do their business, and they leave. And oftentimes I take them to Starbucks Reserve, Pike Place Market, Din Tai Fung, and that's it. You know, that's like, that's all we got is Din Tai Fung and Starbucks Reserve. Yeah. So it's
wait, what were you doing when you had nothing to take people to? What were you doing in your life to go, I noticed that there's a gap, a hole missing in something to do as it relates to Vietnamese restaurants? What were you doing with your life?
In 2008, I was like 26 at the time. And my family migrated from the U.S. To the U.S., like in terms of my older siblings. And they didn't have jobs, right? The economy was going to hell at that time. We was facing that recession coming on, big recession. So I started a small construction landscape company so that my brothers and sisters, my brothers could have jobs. So that, you know, that's a grind, but it made me learn to work with my hands a lot more. So in 2012, you know, I was getting better at, you know, construction, interior construction, building barbecues, building pergolas for people. So it was taking off, and I had saved up a little bit of money. And, you know, my sister had been sad at her job, and she felt like she wasn't appreciated at her job. And she expressed that at home. So I said, you know what? You know, if you don't feel appreciated at work, let me build you something. So that made me build the first Vietnamese restaurant that I own. And I had bought over a deli, a small deli right next to my house. I thought it was convenient for her to work there. So when I opened it, you know, I had the basics, the cơm tấm, the pho, not basic Vietnamese, not like what we're known for. Obviously, pho bánh mì, cơm tấm, bún mắm, you know, I wanted to give people everything. And I quickly realized that, like, man, there's no margin in this business.
Yeah.
If I'm giving people all of this love into the food, and everything is like $8, $9, there's no way this margin, especially how taxing it was for my sister and for the back of house help, you know. And we did well, you know, we was like sales was climbing above 2,000. And I'm like, for this tiny little shop, we're doing $2,000, and yet I don't see any margin because how hard the work was. Right. And that was the opposite of what I thought would be true. I'm like, man, if I can, you know, do $1,000 in sales, that's enough to pay my sister. All I need is like 5-10% margin if I'm not doing anything. And I'm 29, 30 years old at the time, right? And I said, man, this is not it. You know, this is. So I did a quick research into the restaurant industry to see what my peers were doing, what other people were doing. And I found out that Chipotle model, which is fast casual, was really booming at the time. They was growing like 200-300 shops a year, and their margins were great. You know, you want to learn from the best. So I'm always seeking out knowledge. What, you know, and I'm like, what is the Vietnamese community doing? You know, who's the Panda Express of the world? That is the Vietnamese brand. And back then, Pho Hoa was still fairly big, right? But I've eaten at all the pho hoa that was around here. And I'm like, I don't really like this concept. You know, it's my friends owned it, and it's like a powder concept. You know, let me give you the seasoning and you would go do open a franchise kind of idea. So I studied Chipotle, you know, a little bit more. And I thought that there's an opportunity for a Vietnamese fast casual restaurant. So it took me quite a bit of time to get like a landlord to trust me. I came up with a business plan in 2014, I found a location in downtown Seattle, close to Amazon headquarters. And the seller had a Korean taco shop, and he wouldn't leave, right? Unless the price was right. He knew that he had a great location. He just didn't have great food. So yeah, he asked me like for $220,000. The space is 500 square feet on the corner of a building. Yeah. And, but And he had no lease, right? He had nothing to sell. He was on a month-to-month lease. But in my mind, I'm like, man, you sitting on a gold mine. This is in the heart of Amazon country. It was next to the busiest Whole Food in the country. So I did my research and I saw how much lunch traffic was going through Whole Food. And I said, if I even capture 5% of that traffic, I'll make my money back. Right. I'm talking about thousands of people going into Whole Food every day for lunch. It took me 2 years to convince him to leave. I remember giving him a contract for $165,000 and giving him $77 upfront and asking him, hey, I'll pay you $4,000 a month if as long as the landlord don't kick me out because you don't have any lease. So,
But hang on, why would you strike a deal with the lease? Why wouldn't you strike a deal with the landlord? Why would you strike a deal with the leaseholder? I mean, it just doesn't make sense where you would pay that much cash just to get him out, right? Is that what you're doing?
because he had the landlord had no reason to kick him out. He was still running a business there. And essentially, I was buying his rights to be in the space, right? But the landlord was this 75-year-old Turkish dude. He didn't believe in any leases, right? So he owned a building in the middle of the city, and it's Vulcan, it's Paul Allen, it's Bezos around him. He's the only little guy, and he wouldn't sell his building, right? He was like one of the owner operator left, and I got a chance to meet him, and I just said, hey. Why can't you give me a long-term lease? He's like, I don't like all the complications. I'll just shake your hand. If you pay my rent, I will never kick you out. You can just go ask any one of my tenants. That's just the way I do business. And I'm like, so I checked out his businesses, the people there validated for it. So I shook his hand. I said, I know I can get this money back quickly if I had the right concept. And I have to believe in myself, right? So
Yeah,
I have
wow.
a
A lot of
fun me
confidence.
concept. Yeah. So in February 2016, February 24th, I mean, like I signed a I signed and bought the space like in January. February 24th, I remember we opened. Like everybody was saying, I'm crazy, don't do it, don't just throw your money away. Family, they don't see it. So, it was just I had to take a chance because being that I run a mom and pop shop and my numbers weren't great, I had to build my credentials. So, I was lucky enough to be able to give them the 77,000, and I said, let's do it,
Did you
and.
still have the sandwich shop one that you opened with your sister?
I do. Yeah. So to this day, I mean, like, I made my money back in like 8 months, like
At the Amazon one.
at the Amazon one. It's so my shop is called Vina Sun, like the taxi company in Vietnam,
Yeah.
but Sun with an O. So Sun
Okay.
of Vietnam, Vina Sun, right?
I love it.
And yeah, I wanted to represent everything I do, there's a lot of pride involved,
Right,
right?
yeah.
I just don't do it just, I could open a banh mi shop or I can open a burger shop kind of idea, right? I wanted to do something that I'm passionate about. So I mean we got really lucky. We had our lines was like 30, 40 people long every single day. And I just got really lucky that location was booming. Like Amazon was coming in.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Fak. That don't sound like luck to me, man. That sounds like some big courage because you basically said, I'm going to give you 165 grand and I'm going to pay monthly off. That's like a huge bet. That's not luck to me. That's something that is like the ability to see opportunity and to go for it. And now it makes me wonder, how did you become like that? How did you get to the point where you were trusting your instincts to go and go after something with high risk? 500 square feet is a tiny bedroom. It's a bedroom.
It is.
And you're going to take 165 grand in a tiny bedroom based on location.
Yeah, man. So this building is weird. This building sits on a triangle. So like, so it's like, it's literally a triangle. So I knew I had a pickup window in the back. I mapped it out. And I'm like, you know what? I can make this work, you know? And I've always, I'm the youngest in my family, you know? And nobody in my family ever takes risk. Right, because you know I'm always the I'm a monkey by nature. So when you have so many brothers and sisters always protecting you, you kind of dare to be out there a little bit more. Right?
Yeah.
So you know it's you know I always believe in like chance favoring the prepared mind kind of idea, mm-hmm. right? And so I'm always you know naturally we're Vietnamese. We run math is kind of in our blood.
Yeah.
So we're constantly running numbers and it comes natural to just like, you know, if I can see 200 people a day, you know, at a certain number, this is my rent, this is my margins, you know? So if I just got to do what I like, it's just a matter of, can I see enough traffic to go through this space? And, you know, we was really lucky to have the city booming, to have, you know, like at that time, you know, like a quick research back then showed Chicago having like 22 skyscraper, like cranes going up in the skyscraper, right? And at that time, I remember reading a statistic that Chicago being number two in the country in terms of skyscraper, in terms of cranes, right? Like really high cranes. And Seattle at that time had 65.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we was one of the fastest growing city in America. So just being able to stumble upon statistics that just want to validate your vision kind of idea, right? And I needed to talk myself into it because nobody else would nudge me. So yeah, that's it was just I was always operating on that mindset. And
so you kept the first Venus Sun?
Yeah.
And you kept the second Venus Sun?
No, I kept all five of them. I grew.
Good more.
Yeah, so every year I built one more. The construction background really helped.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And then once I had the credentials, now the landlord was coming to me as opposed to me looking for them. And, you know, they started giving me tenant improvement money, you know, basically giving me favorable terms to come in. And I was very lucky. The second one, I did it next to Amazon Fulfillment Center in an industrial zone. You know, I wanted to prove out my concept in three demographics, urban area, industrial area, and suburban areas. So I said, if I can prove out my concept in three different demographics, I have a chance to scale. So the second one I built in 2017, there was a lot of just industry people there that was more into. I was next to REI, Amazon Fulfillment, Bowen. So these somewhat office workers / industrial workers. Again, we had a line to the door every lunch. So it was. I saw that. You know, I was doing something that people would gravitate to. Very organic, you know, it's just like we just focus on really good food, really good ingredients, making it look really nice, open kitchen. So it was newer to have a restaurant be like, you know, really, really clean. That was my focus. Having the kitchen be wide open so people can trust not only the product, but the process. You always people, product, process. If you have those things in place, So I always thought that we had a very presentable system, right? So
Did you go to B school?
I did
Like before construction?
yes, I spent a few years in college. I It's kind of like a dropout, but I knew that those business classes will come in handy,
Yeah,
so,
because everything you're
yeah.
talking about, everything that I'm hearing is like not some random accident. But th there's another level to this conversation as well. So it's the B school, it's the construction. But when I look at the whole presentation of where we are today with you, anchovies and salt, there's a level of taste in the branding of what you've done with anchovies and salt that I recognize. That you know, I'm very surprised to hear five of the Venus Suns are you know sort of like the concept that you tried to do. They don't sound like they're up at that scale, that level of an anchovies and salt, but the taste of the anchovies and salt, from the decor to the lighting to the way you shoot to the way you put your logos on the coconuts, all of these details I literally thought came from a woman. Because you know it has this very elegant soft touch, and you know when we were emailing, I you know your name is Quing, but I thought it was Quing, and so I figured it's a very sophisticated woman, but you know you look like one of those guys I grew up with, you know, like you look like me and I look like you, we grew up in the same, it feels like we grew up in the same time, but the level of sophistication of your branding and your front-facing public persona of the restaurant is, you know, it's just another level. So I want to ask you about that sort of, how did you get to understand how sharp the presentation needs to be to reach a level of where you're at with anchovies and salt?
I think it goes back to just being thinking critically, like, I mean, I probably have to thank my parents for always setting high expectation for us, in a Vietnamese family, we're always taught to be doctors and engineers and lawyers, right? So the critical thinking is big. But at the same time, it's in our dynamic that we all like to be business owners. And so, the lowest hanging fruit is always be doing something with your hands or being in the restaurant business, right? So, you know what? I have to be differentiated. I obviously, when you see a mom and pop shop and you see the struggle that they go through, I mean, it's well, being second generation here or first generation, however you classify it, it's you just don't want to go through the same struggle. If you like, you can't just make the same mistakes or fall into that same trap, if you say, I mean, like, it's not necessarily a trap, but it's just the fact that it's difficult to do it a certain way. So for me, I mean, like, I want it a lot more for us as Vietnamese people. It's like beyond like, hey, we're known for the cheapest food. We got the cheapest banh mi, the cheapest pho. Because if I do that, I'm just like everybody else. And I definitely, like when I look at the greats, like a Chipotle, they gotta do something different, right? There's not too many Chipotle or Panda Express out there, so. There's a Taco Bell, for example, and there's a Chipotle, right? I mean, they both worked. They both made it work, right? But obviously, I had to. I it's just trying to be finding that differentiator.
Now, when you got to number five, why didn't you keep going and go the route of a Chipotle where you could just roll out and scale more? Why did you end at five and then start to do a higher concept restaurant?
Yes. That's a great question. I mean, like, I always plan to, but going back to like when I first went back to Vietnam 20 years ago, I looked at the post-COVID economy in two different ways. I saw how DoorDash and Uber Eats was coming in, and how, inflation was coming in, and the margins were getting thinner and thinner, right? And it's already a thin margin business to begin with. And I looked at the convenience economy as being like extremely convenient one day, right? Amazon Fresh shows up to your house in 1 hour. You can literally select any restaurant with your phone, and the food will come right to your house. And ghost kitchens were popping up everywhere, and there was a lot of noise in the restaurant business. So again, I look back and I said, well, we have now the economy is going to extreme. Like, if I'm going to go out with my family, I need it to be an experience, because I'm not going to go out and pay this inflated prices if it's just the same strip mall food, right? Or and it's not enough of a reason for me to go out. So if I go out, I want to really have a nicer experience. So I call that the convenience economy, and then there's an experience economy. And I thought I was positioning myself for both, right? Because my bowl, my pho, and it's very, very takeout friendly. It was very office friendly. I have a ready-to-eat bowl when you show up at work, a bowl of pho kind of idea. And I'm like, I can run with that, but 10 of those or 20 of those might be the equivalent to one bigger restaurant, right? And when I say big, I was looking at Din Tai Fung style type of big, and I was looking at Slanted Door in San Francisco, because in 2016, I knew they went viral for being one of the best restaurant in the country. And Charles Fan is so like I say, I always look up to the greats and see what they doing that differentiated them. And during my journey through Vietnam and just visiting all these restaurants, I stumble on like Udam in Hanoi, which is a beautiful, humongous vegan restaurant. And it wasn't just the fact that it was the way they presented real food, but it's not even vegan. You won't even know it's vegan if you was looking at it, because it's just food, right? And the class that they was serving it with, the way they presented it, the ambiance, the feel. And I saw how Din Tai Fung is dominating this market up here. There's four Din Tai Fung in Seattle, right? Where there's probably only like, I think there's one in LA, and I don't know that you guys have one in Orange County, but Din Tai Fung kills it up here. Like, 1 hour line.
Here too, it's 1 hour lines. There's one in Glendale, one in Santa Anita, one in Orange County, always packed. And then the one in Glendale, they moved from a big location to a bigger location. It's crazy.
They're doing the same thing in Seattle. They got four locations, and the first location went from 9,500 square feet, and now they moved down to a bigger space, right? So to go back to it, it's like I saw these numbers that they was running, right? And when the opportunity came to be, it was like I have this. There was a competitor to Din Tai Fung from China. It was called a Black Rooster. And I'm excited because it's in my backyard. It's literally a few minutes away from my house. They have this beautiful space on the waterfront of Lake Washington, right next to a four-star Hyatt Regency. And I'm excited. I'm like, man, I don't have to drive 15 minutes to get that Din Tai Fung. This is different. It's called the Black Rooster, right? So I looked them up, and I was just following them, and I'm on the sideline just cheering for them, because I like to have more availability in my community. And COVID hit them, and it was just dragging out. And I heard to the grapevine that they wasn't going to make it. So at that time, I'm exploring this experience economy. I'm telling my friends, is like, hey, if there's an opportunity, like, you either go, we meet up and we talk. We're always shooting the breeze when we're, and I'm sitting with all my buddies, and I'm like, I'm just giving them my 2 cents of what I think this is gonna go, and they will all come into my city, which is a small city on the suburbs of Seattle, right? We're anchored by Boeing, so it's more like an industrial city, but it's up and coming, very much so, up and coming. And I asked them why they were opening in Renton, and they're like, "We love Renton, and we think there's just good potential." And I was hanging out with them real late at night, and I was like, "Man, I would never come back to Renton to do business unless they gave me the waterfront." And right when I said that, I recall that I heard that they was shutting down. So I text my agent and I asked her, I said, "Hey, I heard Black Rooster is closing." And she goes, "Funny you text me, because I got the lease. I'm and it's not public information yet, but I just got it like a couple of days ago." And I'm a little, I had one or two drinks in me, right? And I'm motivated. I said, "I'll take it."
Damn. That is some crazy shit. That is amazing. And did you know the numbers? Did they give you the numbers?
Well, not yet. But so she said, so obviously she's excited. Because she, you know, being my agent, she always knew what I had in my up my sleeve. And she's like, "Okay, you know, obviously we got to get," she's the representative side, she got to get the landlord to agree. So, you know, for her, it was awesome, because now they double dipping. Her company is the listing company, and I'm also her client.
Yeah.
So, not that it helps, you know, because at the end of the day, it took us a year to pitch the concept, to pitch the idea. You know, they wanted high-end Japanese or high-end Mexican food in there. And, you know, I put together my business plan. I just gave them my what my vision was for the space, and they loved it, right? Because they knew it doesn't exist. Like, you know, it's hard to really put into perspective, because we have such common, well, I wouldn't say common is the right word, but like, we're so used to the perception of Vietnamese food being like one way, right? It's where you hold a standard of somebody at like a Brodard, or somebody in Orange County as being the default go-to, right? When I go down there, I used to go to Artists for Nhau food.
Yep.
I would go to Up and Lao for Up food. I would go to Wang Hung for Cơm Gia Đình, and Brodard for the Nem Nướng, right? And then there's a few care places. So you guys have all of the bases covered.
Standardized.
Yes. But I thought, like, well, how about one place that had all the bases covered?
Like a Quang.
Yes, like a Wang Hung, right? So I knew it was an endeavor, right? It's like, that's hard work. There's a reason nobody do it, right? And when we do, it's the pay has to be right for somebody to take that risk. So it would always be like a little bit of fusion, right? Like a crustacean, an anki, a slanted door, where they would call it modern Vietnamese cuisine or French Vietnamese cuisine, because it was. When you combine the best of two culture or three culture, it just tastes better, right? And it's well received. It's not judged, because if somebody's doing fusion food, you don't really have nothing to compare it to. It's either tastes good or it doesn't. If you want to do authentic Vietnamese food, well, now you're going up against the grain, because you're going up against mom's recipes, auntie's recipes, right? So I knew, it's like, I'm like, man, this is borderline stupid, but. But, you know, but it's needed. Like, in my mind, I'm just like, I ask myself, okay, I'm going to travel the country. Where am I going to find food that made me taste like, it tastes like home, but elevated or like different, right? It's not a strip mall. And I always would go to Wang Hung in California, because it gave me that cơm gia đình, that gave me that comfort feeling of going ăn canh cá kho tàu, right? You know, mango fried fish, all of the nostalgic Vietnamese dishes that you know that you only eat at home, and it hasn't made a name, it's fame to claim in the world yet. And it's so I'm like, well, you know, this is a big opportunity, but it's, you know, it's how do you execute something like this, right? But I knew there was a demand, because I said, you know, going back to Din Tai Fung, I'm like, man, I've been here too many times. I'm tired of waiting in line for 2 hours, right? Every Friday, every Saturday morning, every birthday, every Mother's Day, we're waiting in line for an hour just so that my mom can have a seat, right? And she won't go nowhere else because she knows that the Vietnamese places wasn't up to par. It was too, it was, you know, for lack of a better word, we don't put enough love into it, right? It's just, it's a matter of a business. It's, and it's, you know, we've been.
It's a very practical thing to do to go to a Vietnamese restaurant, is to get full off of good food, but it's not catering to the experience of a birthday or a celebration, an anniversary.
Exactly. So that's when I think I wrote to the VOF. It's like, look, my mission is very simple. Is how do I make a place where you are proud enough to take your mom there for, you know? And it was like, if I can get your mom to show up just simply for the scene, for the culture, for the ambiance, the location, she feels good. She might not like my food, right? But if I could work hard enough for her to like my food, to put a stamp on it, then there's no question that somebody else, that everybody else would like it, right? So I said my mission is very simple. Is how do I get parents to get out of the house to eat Vietnamese food? And, you know, it's a joke among all of us. It's like among the Asian community in general that it's a very, very difficult thing to do. And that's why I said, that's why the opportunity is really big. So you don't know how tired I am of showing up to waking up on a Sunday morning. And the only thing that is available as an option is bacon and eggs and French toast, or which the good places up in Seattle is still an hour away.
Wow. Right?
And then there's Taiwanese or Chinese dim sum, right? It's so common that it's dim sum is not a brunch thing. It's just dim sum. It's a vocabulary and a category in itself, right? But there's really no third culture that really has stake a claim to that type of where you said this is Vietnamese brunch, right? You don't call it dim tam or something like that, right? There's no culture that has been able to do that or has captivated the audience. You know, until NEP came along in Southern California.
Man, you study right? Everything. You study right. All these restaurants. You know the ins and outs of all the California spots, like bringing up NEP and Key Concepts and what they've done down here. It's you have to know the landscape very well to categorize all of these structural sort of inner workings in the food space for Vietnamese people. Without that knowledge, I think it's hard to kind of define where you're going to be.
Oh, I needed to know my place, you know, and NEB is super, super awesome, you know, but even when I go there, you know that the demographic there is us. We are like, we as a Vietnamese, we like that. We love on there, right? And you go there, I remember waiting 45 minutes there, and I'm just chatting with there's only two white people there. And they came from a long way, and it was because it still hasn't, Fountain Valley is very much Vietnamese, right? It hasn't kind of like, you know, you can be Asians and all that, but Vietnamese brunch is still not at top of mind for mainstream America kind of there. And I think they know that, right? I mean, like they cater to a very specific market, which is the Vietnamese tourist market, right? At 8:30, they are lining up. They open the door at 9 o'clock and everybody wants to get in. And so we know that the Vietnamese community really love this, which is why I said, okay, if I make Bon Air, I'm going to introduce it to the Vietnamese community first. And being that it's next to the Hyatt, being that it's next to corporate, next to Bowen, people will see that, man, this place is big, it's beautiful, but it's full of Vietnamese people. It must be authentic. And that's why I try really hard to stay away from anything that is fusion. Even though modern cooking, you know, there's going to be touches in it that makes it, it has a lot of cultural influence, right? A lot of people don't know. Go ahead, brother.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam. So let me ask you this. I could hear your vision. The mark of success for you is, will my mom and dad come with me to brunch on the regular, on these big events like birthdays and celebration? So your mark of success, it sounds to me, it's not a money thing. It's a very cultural mark. I want to see if I can get the approval from our first generation, our parents, to show up and make it a regular thing. But I do have a question. That's your mark. But today, I don't know how long you've been in operation, but do you find that it's more of the white community that's going to this beautiful restaurant? Or have you got that even with the parents' generation, our parents' generation? Is it equal, like 50-50? Where does this sort of demographics lie right now?
You know, I would say right now it's more so the Vietnamese community that's been supporting me, which has been, it's been amazing. Like I haven't seen so many people come out of the house for so long. You know, it's the Vietnamese community here. I wouldn't call it tight knit, you know, but it's small enough to where,
you know,
when I make a splash this big, they know. And it don't need to be in the Vietnamese newspaper or anything like that. But, and I strategically, you know, I went right after the Vietnamese market first. That was just my thing, because most of my friends are Vietnamese, word of mouth is going to be there. And I went after the dishes I knew would touch there. That like, we're talking about soul food, you know, Vietnamese soul food.
Vietnamese soul food.
And it, that was it. Like, instantly they knew that I had things like cà pháo mắm tôm at night, right? And I have mắm tôm from Hanoi. So shrimp paste is, you know, like, these are the things that people tell us never to put on the menu, right? Because it would scare. This is stuff you can't bring to school, right? In my restaurant, being anchovies and salt, I mean, like, I have 10 different fish sauces. I have mắm nêm, which is anchovy paste. Bro, like, if you come in and you look at it and you taste all the flavors, you know that I didn't dilute down one thing, right? Because I refuse to dilute it, because it's like diluting the culture. It's appropriating my food to kind of meet somebody else's expectation. But the expectation I'm going for is the moms of the world, the Vietnamese moms. So you can't play. You can't just have it be mediocre and get their stamp of approval. So I R&D the sauces, right? And my mom had great sauces. It's always been her best thing, is her nước mắm. But then, you know, and then mắm ruốc is like ubiquitous to pretty much all region. But in the north, they eat it very strong. They eat like a purple shrimp paste with the bún đậu mắm tôm, chả cá lá vọng, right? And I'm like, yeah, I'm feeding that to everybody. It's like, I can't be apologetic about the culture.
Absolutely.
And represent culture, you know? So it's like, you know, if people will see the restaurant on the internet, for example, they're thinking, oh, it's fusion, it's too nice to be Vietnamese. But the opposite is true because it's nothing but fish sauce and shrimp paste in my space. That's kind of the foundation of everything I built it on.
And that is sort of the vibe that I get. It's like the restaurants in Vietnam are unapologetic. You go into these big ones and it's decked out and it feels very luxurious, but then they're serving super traditional because it's their fucking country. This is where they live. They're like, we don't give a rat's ass about what you think about what we're serving. We're going to make it beautiful and we're going to deck it out and be decadent. And we're still going to serve the most basic, all of that stuff is or weck, you know, all of those things are still like these dishes in the rural countryside that is served in these high-end restaurants. And I think that's, it feels like that's where you've gone with anchovies and salt. But I do have a question about the head chef. Like, did you have to find somebody or were you just working with somebody who's a gun for hire?
Gun for hires. So I always knew what my palate would be, right? During my travel, I said, well, one, if I needed a chef and I lose the chef, what happens to my restaurant?
Right.
Yeah. So it's like, and how many chefs can cook food from all three regions of Vietnam? So our food is very sauce-based, very recipe-driven. So I went out and I was searching for the youngest kid, the most, the one with the most energy, the most aspiration, the most passion to represent their culture. And that was my goal during all my interviews, is like, these kids got to have pain points. Like, they need to know that, well, how come I don't get to cook Vietnamese food, right? Because you're not, if you go to a pho restaurant, you're not cooking any Vietnamese food. So French-trained Vietnamese kids, they're not going out to the world to cook Vietnamese food. They're cooking fusion at best, right? So when I put the ad up for when I was hunting, I found this little girl. She's 27 years old, and she was working at a American place, and she had the menu was 100% American except for the bonnet. She had, because her boss would allow her to put it on the menu because it was the most, it was similar to American food, right?
That is funny. Super funny. Yeah.
So I had a friend told me, hey, there's this Vietnamese girl. She works here. She's looking for something. You should go check her out. And then when I saw the bonnet on there, naturally, I that's the first thing I ordered. And I thought it had really good flavors to it. It was like, okay, this is it, right? So I found, you know, I got a chance to meet a really nice young, and she's been through the ringer. You know, she's been through the pho shops, the French restaurant. In her short 6-7 years, she worked in almost all the restaurants. And she made her way up, and I'm like, you are ambitious. You work hard. I can see it. Because being 27 and running an American establishment is difficult. But she was getting burnt out there. So she was getting ready to leave. That's how I got word of it. So I brought her on. At that time, I brought in another guy from Amazon. And he was from San Francisco. He came up here. He worked for like a fusion Vietnamese place. And I met him through friends of friends, and he was the executive chef at Amazon. So he was cooking like in the cafeteria, making cafeteria food, and he was in corporate. So I said, hey, you want to come back out to retail and do something special? Yeah. And he didn't have no Vietnamese flavor either. Like, he was just eating like Vietnamese American food all his life, and he didn't learn in any Vietnamese setting to have that palate. But I said, don't worry about it. My mom will teach you guys everything, you know? Just go to my mom's house, and we're just going to play with the recipe. We will R&D it. But then I have a really good friend from Vietnam, and he's young, 30-year-old kid. To me, he had the best palate of anybody I knew in Vietnam, because when he took me to places to eat, it was all amazing places. Right? It was like the flavor was where I'm like, damn, this is amazing. And he was blessed, right? This kid is privileged enough to be able to travel the whole country and eat. His family has restaurants. He basically is their culinary director. He tells the restaurant people what to cook. And he was able to replicate flavors really well. So he would often cook for me when I visit him. And like, you know, we go to Hanoi and I eat the best food and I'm in Saigon with him. He said, don't worry about it. We don't need to go to Hanoi. I'll cook it for you. And it would come out. It was like, I'm like, dang, this kid has talent, right? He doesn't need to work for anybody, but because he's blessed, but he has crazy talent. So I invited him over. I said, I need you to come over to the States for a couple months and just R&D the crap out of my team. So we had three kids. We brought on two more kids that were French trained. One of them came from Saigon when he was 17. So he had like the Vietnamese palate. One kid grew up in the US and was working for like really nice American restaurants. And they, when they heard me coming, they was really passionate. They knew that they was gonna come to me to get a job because they wanted to cook Vietnamese food. And when I told them Vietnamese food, they was very surprised, right? Because for a lot of them, they've never even tasted these flavors. You know, like if you are a 17-year-old kid from Saigon, you don't really get to go to Hanoi to eat a lot, right? Especially if you're working as a chef. You know, you gotta be balling, you gotta have money to travel and eat. So a lot of them, they didn't get to taste any of these flavors yet. One kid knew the Saigon flavor well. The little girl was from Hue, so she know what Hue flavor tastes like. But none of them had ever had northern food. So luckily, my culinary director, the guy from Vietnam, he was born and raised in the north. But then they migrated to the south so that he had flavors of both regions. And I'm like, okay. We definitely can deliver all three flavors if we R&D this. And we just started with a big, really big menu, right? Just like, okay, how do we get it? What's the most popular? What can we make the best? What can it, well, how do we flow, you know? Because it's the flow inside the kitchen, as you know, is going to be super important. Yeah, so we were lucky enough to R&D, and my team is super young, bro. Like wow. 27, 25, 25.
Now, I want to ask a little bit about your background. You sound like you are from a northern family, right? So, but I have a feeling that your northern family came down to the south in 1954. I don't think you grew up in Hanoi, did you?
No. I'm actually from the south. My grandpa and grandma was from Uy Nhơn, Nam Định.
Okay, so yeah.
Nam Định. And but in 42, they moved to the south. So this is when my dad was only like 4 years old, you know, in 1942. And my dad is like 86 now. I grew up in the south. I grew up in the U.S. technically, because I've been in the U.S. for 30 years. But I just happened to, when I started this restaurant industry, there's a lot of kids that come to work for me, you know. And they would ask for a job, just more so a lot of them just needed time to kill, you know, like they would be bored or just like, hey, I just want to learn to be in business. Can you give me a job so I can see what the day to day is like? And I, more often than not, I became really good friends with them. So I married a Hue woman. So I'm always listening to Hue a lot of times. And then when I'm back in Vietnam, a lot of my friends are in the north. So I get to go up there a lot and just kind of absorb the culture up there, you know? So.
But it's weird because every time you speak Vietnamese, it sounds like a very heavy northern accent. But I know that very few people grew up in the north actually make it to the United States, you know, 30 years ago, right? Because that's just the history. The history is everybody's moving out from the south. So, you know, anybody who's northern dialect speaking is typically from northern families that moved down to the south that escaped, you know, at 5 years old, 10 years old, like yourself. So, yeah. You know, it's always interesting, the Nam Dinh or the Bắc, you know, Bắc Ninh of the world, because my mom is from that area. And I always notice a pattern that you never get anybody from the north that left in 75 to 85 or 90. It's impossible. They just didn't leave. So you get all the Northerners that were from Binyung or, you know, all these places in the South that come over to the United States that retain their Northern dialect.
Yeah. And actually, I misspoke quickly. I'm from Binden, and my chef is from Namden.
Ah, got it.
His family is from Namden, which is for a lot of people, I think it's the origin of pho. That's where pho was founded. So that's why it was tip of tongue. But my grandpa was from Win Young, and my family, we actually settled in Binyung. So
that's exactly it. That's the pattern, right? There's a pattern to all this stuff, man. It's crazy. The migratory patterns of the North, because you go to actual areas of Binyung, right, in the South, and it's like, it's all Northern people. And you're like, what the hell? You guys have been here for 50 years and you still speak, you know, this heavy Northern Hanoi accent. It's the most bizarre thing every time I encounter it. It's crazy. There's, you know, people that I run into and are good friends with in Vietnam that speak heavy Northern, but they were born in the South. Like, you know, they're 55-year-old guys and born in the South. It's crazy, crazy stuff. Now, let me ask you about this idea of the biggest restaurant. How do you know that this is the biggest Vietnamese restaurant outside of Vietnam?
You know, it was never the idea or nor the intention. I'm in construction, so I've been building all my own restaurant. So I'm reading blueprints and I see my permit and it says max occupancy 441, right? And I'm like, whoa, that's a lot. So I'm like, okay, I remember Brodar being pretty big, right? The new Brodar in Orange County. And I looked it up and I remember actually looking at it one time. It's just these things catch my attention. And it's 8,000 square feet, 297.
Right. It ain't 400 for sure. I was even just thinking 200, the Brodar first.
Yeah, it's 200, but 297, including the people in the back, including the employees. Because we're talking about fire department maximum occupancy. So the employees are included, right? So when I remember that, and I said, well, during my travels, the only thing I know of is La Colonial in San Francisco, Slanted Door in San Francisco. And Slanted Door is 120 seats, 175 max occupants.
Yeah. I mean, it's not tiny, but it's not as big as Brodard.
No. And then I went to Anki in, is it Costa Mesa?
Yep. Costa Mesa.
Yep. And I looked them up, and I think they were like around 7,000 square feet. And I've been to the Crustaceans, and I know that it's not that big. Yeah. So I'm like, the only thing left is La Colonial in San Francisco, which is 10,000 square feet inside, outside. They got that big awning, the big patio up front. And when I dined in there, it felt claustrophobic inside. I said, this is not that big. Yeah. So I said, this can't be it. So then they opened another La Colonial in Atlanta. I've been to that one, and that one is nice and beautiful, 7,000 square feet. Right. So I'm like, okay, this is all the biggest Vietnamese community in America. I went to Miami. There's hardly anything down there. And then I looked at New York, at Indochine, New York, which is not even Vietnamese. It's French Vietnamese. And it's like 150 seats maximum. So I'm like, holy smoke, I'm at 441, right? Max occupancy. I'm like, what else is there? And I always knew Kim Sung was big, right? And I like, Kim Sung is like 35,000 square feet, three times my size. But I'm looking at them as buffet. They have Chinese food. They have Japanese food.
Wedding banquet hall kind of stuff.
Yes. So I'm like, does that count, right? And when you have a banquet hall that caters dim sum or Chinese food, I think that should not consider as a Vietnamese restaurant, or especially if it's elevated or like a upscale dining establishment. Yeah. Right? So I said, okay, that don't count. Some people might consider it, but I don't, right? So let's, for the sake of just finding numbers, then I looked up the biggest in the world, and I know in Sydney, Australia, the Red Lantern by Luke Nguyen is like 270 something. And I can't find anything bigger than that. And I'm asking my friends in Europe, I'm like, what do you guys have that's big over there? They say, we don't have anything that's big that's Vietnamese, right? So I, everything I've looked at, I'm like, if Europe is a Vietnamese destination, so the only two places that I can't find information on is inside of Russia and inside of China, right? Because China, they don't really have a lot of public information on the internet. So everything I looked at, I'm like, there's no Vietnamese restaurant that is this big. So, you know, and I'm skeptical to run with it, right? Because it conveys to some people, it conveys pride, right? This is a pride of a community. To some people, they laugh at it. They're like, well, how do you know? And that happened before, you know? And I'm like, well, I have to do my research, right? So I almost consider at one time I was going to put second biggest Vietnamese restaurant in the world. And then people would say, well, what's the first? I said, I don't know. Do you know?
That would be cool. That would be cool. You know, when I first heard of the biggest Vietnamese restaurant in the world, that I didn't think about any of the pride. I didn't think about any of that stuff. I only thought about one thing. I was like, how do you make a place that big not long? Right. Yep. Not watered down, not, yep, you know, at an elevated sort of stance. How do you make it tight, and how do you run it to where the flavors still hold after you're serving all these hundreds of people? And so I kept thinking about, you know, fine dining, elevated. How do you keep that level, that pacing consistent at that volume?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's the hardest thing, which is why it doesn't get attempted, right? Because you have to be able to, like, I was very blessed that during all my construction years that I always run into trouble with architects and architecture because they would design, but they're not in the restaurant business. They don't think like a restaurateur. They don't think like an operator. They want to get cute most of the time. So when I designed this, I actually had a map in my mind, and I intentionally hired a Bulgarian architect from Las Vegas. I just told him, I said, look, man, I just need you to do what I tell you and lay this out for me with this vision in mind. You might not get all the aesthetics, the nuances, but we'll get there when we'll cross that path when we get there. So I got this young architect that I was introduced to. I saw some of his work. I said, design this in a way where it represents Vietnam. I want all 7, 8 regions of Vietnam here. I got Saigon. I got Ban Nha. I got Da Nang. The bar is Da Nang. The main banquet hall is Saigon, obviously for scale size. The kitchen is the Ban Nha kitchen. The VIP room is a Hoi An lantern room. I built it into a beautiful lantern. The upstairs mezzanine overlooking the water, I want it to be the Hoi Imperial Lounge. Say, so make it look like it's Imperial. And then the north end of the restaurant, I want a private room for Hanoi, Sapa, and Ha Long Bay. And my restaurant is super long. It's like almost 200 linear feet. And I broke it down into 3 sections, Saigon, Central, and then North. So that when you walk through the space, every corner feels warm. Every corner feels, you see culture everywhere you go. And it needs to be that part of the culture, right? So in Saigon, I would have just a lot of craftsmanship that goes back to, you know, let's say old school Vietnamese, right? I have a picture of Nhà Thờ Đức Bà, the Notre Dame Cathedral. I have a picture of Bến Thành, right? Bến Thành Market. And then I would just have things like, you know, feng shui stuff that would kind of represent, oh, this is like a, you can tell this is an Asian Vietnamese restaurant right away. And then, so the space, like if you, I mean, like, I think that's what, we have all this space and we can only have 20 people and it will still feel busy because it's sectioned out to where, you know, I always knew that it would feel weird if this restaurant, if you had a banquet hall and there's only 10 people sitting in there, it would feel really weird. So it needed to be sectioned out to where, like, okay, you know, if you sit in the big ballroom, there's a lot of distraction. You're not, if you have five people, you're still looking at the whole lake. Mm-hmm. So your mind is not how slow this restaurant is, but you enjoying the lake view, you know? So, like, to be fair, like, we lucked out on probably the most beautiful property you can have in Seattle. Like, I have 100 seats on the water. Wow. And I'm talking about the boats, they pull right up, and I can serve you on your boat. You get 3-hour parking. There's like, I have a cruise ship that is like, no, not a cruise, a yacht. The biggest yacht that ever pulled up is 110 feet. Like a super yacht almost, right? 110 feet. And they just pull up right to the restaurant. That is like, how do you get that, right? And the hotel is the one of the fourth most busiest hotel in the whole country.
Oh, wow.
Hyatt Regency, because it's on the water. The park right next to me is like the central park of Renton. It's like the population that goes there, there's like 200-300 parking, and it's always packed. So like just I'm like, this, and it's in the neighborhood where it's very inclusive, where the income is not like, you don't feel like you can't breathe. You walk in there, everybody belongs there. There's kayaking, there's paddleboarding, there's ice cream. You know, it's like you go, there's a kids playground. So you go there and I'm like, anybody walks onto this dock and this waterfront, you will feel like, oh man, this is a nice place to hang, to bring my family. You won't get looked at in a way where it's too rich or too poor.
Right. You know,
but you're not also not at the same time watching your back be like this, you know? So it's waterfront, you know?
Yeah.
And then we're anchored by Boeing factory. So when you walk out my door, you see all these Boeing airplanes. Mm. Like, we're talking about all the 737s, right? And so it's like, location-wise, you just can't. There's no way you can beat it in terms of how inviting it is, right? So I knew when as big as it is, I'm like, you know what? This will put Vietnamese restaurant on the map, right? Because, and I'm less than 15 minutes from the airport. So all the pilot, they stay at that hotel because Alaska Airlines. So I'm like, okay, stewardess is going to come. Pilots is going to come. If they post about me, their audience is national. Their audience is global. Their audience is not Seattle. So I had that advantage to like all these travelers, if they were to check in or post anything about us, it has a national reach immediately. So even during my R&D, I would fly it. I would invite my friends from New York, like Chef Helen Nguyen at Saigon Social. I invite Nikki Tran from Houston. I invite Andy Nguyen from Orange County. You probably know Andy real well. So I said, look, man, I need you guys to tell me what my missing links are. What do you guys have in New York? What do you have in Houston? And Orange County, of all people, right? I invite as much people from Orange County as I can up here because I want to tell them, look, I think what I have is differentiated, right? I have Wang Hung, but on a whole different level, right? And that's what Andy told me. He goes, I've lived here. I live in Orange County all my life. I've never had this food. I said, yeah. I mean, like, I go down there and I search for this food and I couldn't find it, right? So it's like, that's one of the reasons I wanted to invite them up here to see what it is that I thought that everybody was missing, right? Like, Wang Hung, when you go there, you're going to get catfish in your kakotao, right? And I said, well, that's too easy because anybody, but is the, like, if somebody with a more refined palate who got a bigger pocket, do they want to eat catfish?
Right.
Or
right.
Do they want to eat sea bass or black cod inside their kakotao, right? Or I asked myself a simple question, right? If I was to put a catfish and a black cod and it's my mom's birthday, right? Which one am I cooking for my mom that day?
I'm going to do the black cod. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So. Yeah. That's the level of elevation I'm referring to when I said, okay, if we're going to cook, if I'm going to do baluklak and I have the cheap $2.99 cut or I got the Wagyu, I'm going to use Wagyu to feed my mom. I'm not going to give my mom the cheapest cut out there. And that's where we put that love into the food, but don't dilute the flavor. It's like you can't make gakotao go bad if you use black cod because it's so rich and it's so bell. So, you know what? That's during R&D. It's like if I'm going to do kaching ng mamsai, I was already in R&D in halibut, yeah. Halibut cheeks, sea bass, local link cards, right? All the, because I'm a big fisherman. So I'm like, okay, where's my king salmon, my coho salmon, my steelhead? I'm bringing all of these Northwest flavors. So even when you come from California, you'd be like, oh man, you guys got a lot of salmon up here, right? Like I needed Orange County people to see that, well, we don't see a lot of link cod because that's more like Bay Area. Right, because you don't catch a lot of them down in closer to the warm water of Mexico. Or if you come up here, gooey duck is a lot cheaper than it is down in San Francisco. Spotted prawns, you know. So I'm like, you know what? I can go the route of Auckland and give people nostalgic Auckland or Auckland Sayur. But I'm like, man, those things are frozen, right? They're frozen, and it's a lot of work just to bring the flavor to be like, what you want it to be, right? Because you have to wash it like 10 times before you serve it. Where if I get something fresh out of the Pacific Northwest, I don't have to do anything to it. It's going to taste amazing. So I didn't want to go the route of being an up and low. I wanted to go the route of like, okay, I want to be the freshest seafood. I want to be like a Joel Crab Shack, right? If you come up here and you eat food, even if you come from Vietnam, you're like, well, I never get to eat this in Vietnam because that's so when you know my menu for my finger food menu is going to be gooey duck, Northwest razor clam, it's going to be Northwest scallops. You know, there's things that we have. Like, I have this thing I'm so excited to put on the menu. In Washington, there's a scallop called Singer scallops, it's pink, and it's very difficult to get because they live at 200 feet or below. But they move through the water because they sing like this. So they move because they propel by blowing water out of the shell.
Wow.
So and it's pink, right? And you almost never see it on the menu because divers are afraid to go that deep.
Yep.
So in Washington, as a shrimp fisherman, I would catch it accidentally in my shrimp pots. So that's how I would know that these things exist and they are really good, right? And I would read up on it and seasonally there's some companies that would offer it, you know, so just like things like that, just to be able, like, even the people, my own community, whether they are white or they are Vietnamese, they don't know that these pink scallops exist. So we have so much abundant of natural resources, and I just, you know, just imagine doing that with my Vietnamese scallion and some fish sauce, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of my goal with the finger food aspect of it, you know, because we gravitate to that when we want to have a beer or a cocktail. And I'm on the waterfront with cocktails and a bar that opens up to the water. So, you know, that's not like the main focus of the menu. At the end of the day, it's still like come yet then with black cod, right? Or it's Ram Mung Sao, or it's Kanchua with king salmon from the Northwest. The dishes still has to be extremely Vietnamese, right? And I'm sure we've all done kanchua with ca salmon at home, but really nobody sells it in the restaurant because they know the margin's not going to be there if you sell king salmon.
Right. Quing, again, you know, I started by saying that I was coming for one thing and I got another thing. You know, I got this huge vat of knowledge and information about you know, the way an elevated, I usually always ask chefs and people who come on the show, you know, why things can't be priced. But it's like, I don't even need to ask that with you. And I came to this realization today that the future is here. And what I mean by that is that I've been asking, why can't we charge like the French and the Italian? Why can't we like raise our prices? But now we're here. We are here. You've elevated it. You've put us in a space where we can proudly say, okay, look at Anchovies and Salt. Look what they're doing. Look what Quing is doing up there. So I dream of one day coming up to Renton and going to the restaurant. And I hope that all of the Vietnamese American, you know, public know about this restaurant, because, you know, it sounds to me like something that is, again, like I said, it was the standard was like, I was trying to attain it for our community and seeking out where that point of excellence is. And I think we're at the point in the history of our future that we're now arriving at this place where anchovies and salt is sort of like that flagship marker that we've hit. And this is based on not just me reading about this, but me hearing other members of the Viet Leaders Forum talk about it. So I want to thank you for your time today. And thank you for, you know, going so in depth about the food business with me.
And thank you, brother. It's my privilege to be able to share it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.